As African colonies achieved independence over the last half of the 20th century, the Organization of African Unity, now renamed the African Union, took a different position. They took the position that however absurd the colonial borders might be, they should nevertheless be respected. And the men who actually run Chad and the Sudan have supported this position. In a broad sense, the two adjoining lands are mirror images of each other, each divided into an Islamic North and a non-Islamic South who do not get along very well and who have experienced great regional imbalances in development. In the Sudan, it is the Islamic North that grew rich under colonialism and the South that has felt obliged to fight for its legitimate rights. In Chad, it was the other way around. In cases of disagreement since independence, each government has been able to twist the other's arm by supplying, or threatening to supply, the other's perennial rebels. Northern Chadian Muslim rebels, tied by history to the wider Tunjur experience and by ethnicity to kinsmen in Darfur, have never taken the border very seriously. Their first major organization, the Front de Libération Nationale du Chad, or FRONLINA, was formed in Darfur at the town of Niala in June 1966. In return, the government of independent Chad, an archetypical neo-colony strongly influenced by the French, has felt free to enter Darfur to attack rebels right from the beginning. With the vicissitudes of weather and the ebb and flow of rebel fortunes in Chad, refugees from either side have occasionally crossed the border in order to survive, and like their ancient counterparts, the artificial kinsmen, they are not treated very well by their hosts. They expect to return to their homes someday. Since independence, the primary responsibility for Darfur has been in the hands of a number of successive Sudan governments based in Khartoum. The country inherited from the British a parliamentary form of government, which has alternated over the years with a series of military dictatorships. The current dictator is named Omar al-Bashir. During the parliamentary interludes, the country's four major political parties become visible. Two of these parties began large, with widespread, humble, rural constituencies, and then shrank. Two parties began small, with educated, urban constituencies, and grew. The first large party comprises the followers of the Sudanese Mahdi, the Ansar, or the Ummah Party. In recent years, their leader has been Sadiq al-Mahdi. In elections, Darfur was a major Ansar bastion. The second party are followers of the older pro-Egyptian 19th century neo-Sufi organization, the Khatmiya, who, however, are not widely represented in Darfur. Several of the military dictators were, in fact, supporters of this party. The third, smaller, educated, and urban-based party are the communists. Their influence peaked in 1969 when a dictator expressed sympathy toward them for about 2 years. The fourth party, originally also urban-based and educated, is the National Islamic Front, an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. Its leader at the beginning of the Darfur crisis was the prominent Sudanese Islamist intellectual Hassan al-Turabi. South Sudan rebelled on the eve of independence, and except for a truce during the 1970s, the country has experienced a full half century of civil war. For many years, the South has been organized politically by the Southern People's Liberation Army and Movement, led by John Garang de Mabior. In recent months, a fragile peace settlement between North and South Sudan has been hammered out. John Garang was killed in a helicopter crash. The future is uncertain. In its half century of independence, the Khartoum government could have rewritten Sudan's national priorities to benefit neglected and abused colonial peripheries such as Darfur. In the event, they chose not to change anything until disaster, both natural and man-made, struck, and it is to this story that we must now turn. It will be convenient to visualize the onset of the Darfur crisis in terms of two successive axes of external influence. There's a north-south axis based on Benghazi and an east-west axis based on Khartoum. Before we begin to immerse ourselves in detail, it would be well to point out that the two axes express themselves in different ideological idioms. The Libyan axis used the idiom of Arabism. Is it not a very fine thing to be an Arab? The Khartoum axis used the idiom of Islam. Is it not a very fine thing to be a Muslim? Each of these statements resonated positively in Darfur, but both, alas, also carried the potential for violent abuse and for the justification of atrocity. Let us begin with the Libyan connection. When Gaddafi took over Libya in 1969, he began a program of taking over the Sahara, starting with Chad. He had oil, and his unlimited wealth enabled him to dabble in politics all the way from Belfast to the Philippines. And in the Sahara, in his own backyard, his agenda was limited only by his conceptualization of the problem. Gaddafi was, and probably still is, a racist. Only pure Juhayna Arabs like himself deserve to rule, while non-Arabs in the Sahara, pejoratively known as Zurga, or blacks, should be seen as recent intruders into the region who should be killed or expelled. Now, to pursue his ambitions in the Sahara, Gaddafi started a number of organizations. One was charitable. The Munazamat Da'awa al-Islamiyya offered free education and welfare handouts to those willing to play along with the Libyan agenda. A second was the strike force with which Gaddafi intended to conquer the Sahara. It was called the Falak al-Islamiyya, or Islamic Legion. It was patterned on the French Foreign Legion, or in more recent times, Al-Qaeda. It incorporated armed thugs from every conceivable Islamic land, as well as bloody-minded Muslims from elsewhere, too. The base for arming and training this force was the old Senussi capital of Kufra in southern Libya. Now, at this point in the discussion, I should mention that the heartland of Darfur is about the size of the American state of California, but it has a population of perhaps only 5 million people. It is not particularly difficult to set up bases in various quarters without drawing immediate attention. So Gaddafi's Islamic Legion moved in, made itself at home, began to gather local recruits, and became a permanent fixture in the politics of Darfur. Thirdly, Gaddafi started an organization for Darfur itself. This was called the Tejemaa al-Arabi, or Arab Union, which gathered all those in Darfur receptive to his call. Conspicuous among these were the minor pastoral tribes who had never received recognition from the sultans of old and who had sat out most of the 20th century cooling their heels while the British refused to play the traditional political game that might otherwise have rewarded at least some of them. But now their time had come, for a new generation of patrons, starting with Gaddafi, was willing to see the status quo rewritten at last. Now, in Gaddafi's mind, the two marks of Africanness were the cultivation of crops and the possession of a native language other than Arabic. In Sudanese Arabic, the idiom is, Anduhum Rotana, do they have a language other than Arabic? Some people in Darfur did, others did not. Until 1969, it hardly mattered. By now, it has become a matter of life and death. The actual documents that exposed the doctrines of Gaddafi's Arab Union, called Quraysh I and Quraysh II, did not surface until 1987 and 1988, but by then the ideas were well implanted among those groups receptive to them. And there was more to the Libyan program. The people of the northern Nile Valley Sudan itself, most of whom had no language other than Arabic, were nevertheless characterized by Gaddafi as half-breed mongrels who should never have been allowed to exercise authority over true Darfur Arabs. The future of Darfur should never have been linked to these racially inferior Khartoum degenerates. But Gaddafi could not wait, nor was Darfur the only item on his agenda. In 1973, the Islamic Legion crossed the border to begin operations in Chad, and the Libyan intervention continued with mixed results until the eventual consolidation of power by Idriss Déby in and following 1990. Meanwhile, in 1976, Gaddafi formed an alliance with Sadiq al-Mahdi, current head of the Sudanese Ansar, and with the Muslim Brothers. He sponsored an invasion of the Sudan. The rebels held Khartoum, the capital, for several days. I remember because every time they machine gunned the Pink Palace, the faculty housing complex where I was living, my host Peter Gerritsen and I would have to lie in the bathtub together listening to machine gun bullets ping off the side. But for our purposes, the most lasting legacy of the Libyan intervention was the spread of the doctrines of Arabism within Darfur itself. Certain groups there were being taught how to hate, and they were being given an idiom of expression that incorporated potentially genocidal goals. But now let us turn to the second axis, the axis based upon Khartoum. During the years that immediately followed independence, successive parliamentary and military regimes didn't change much in Darfur. The province formed an electoral bastion for the Ansar Party during parliamentary interludes. In 1969, a new dictator, Jafar Nimeiri, began a brief two-year flirtation with the Sudanese communists. I remember the red stars that suddenly appeared on soldiers' uniforms and the long re-education meetings that all of us were obliged to attend, even foreigners in remote villages, through which we learned how to become good Sudanese socialists. Leading members of the Ansar and Muslim Brotherhood fled the country at that time, and some, as we have learned, settled in Libya and began planning the invasion of 1976. Meanwhile, Nimeiri struck a truce with the southern rebels that gave the Sudan most of a decade of peace. But the dictator soon revealed himself to be a complete opportunist. He dropped the communists within months, eventually made peace with the Islamist faction, and in the end sabotaged his own southern settlement. For Darfur, Nimeiri's most important act was the abolition of the existing system of local government called native administration. And so it was that starting in the year 1971, the long freeze on elite status within the region ended, and the processes of competition and change began again. A new generation of politicians arose, men who not only enjoyed ties to the traditional elites so beloved of the British, but who had also experienced Western education and held links to the modern global economy. Some were communists or Islamists, while others were reform-minded Ansar or primarily secular representatives of local ethnic constituencies. The culmination of this movement came in 1980 when Nimeiri installed in Darfur a new provincial government headed by the secular ethnic Fur leader Ahmed Derej, who swept away many long-toothed Ansar cronies of the British and replaced them with a reasonably diverse mix of younger local leaders. But the pace of political change was now destined not only to accelerate, but to do so in unexpected and unfortunate directions. As Nimeiri's years lengthened, he fell increasingly under the tutelage of the Islamists. One consequence was a rekindling of the revolt in the south, now led by John Gadang's SPLA-NM. Hasna Tarabi sought to undercut the traditional parties by extending his organization, eventually known as the National Islamic Front, out into their rural bailiwicks, and he enjoyed some success in Darfur at the expense of the Ansar, especially among the Zghawa Kobe and the Masalit. I had to listen to long lectures from Ibrahim Yahya, a schoolteacher and one of Tarabi's Maslahi agents, who translated for Lidvin Kaptains as we rode for weeks at a time on the back of the trucks that carry travelers from Omdurman to El Geneina and back. From the perspective of Ibrahim Yahya, the National Islamic Front offered a solution to the neglect and mismanagement and marginalization of Darfur, and especially of African groups such as his own Masalit, at the hands of the traditional parties such as Sadiq al-Mahdi's Ansar. To many in Darfur, and particularly among the young, Islamic fundamentalism seemed to promise equality and modernization to be erected on a foundation of sound moral and ethical principles. In time, however, and here I am cutting a very long story short, Hasna Tarabi proved himself to be at least as unprincipled an opportunist as was Nimeiri. His tactical twists and turns alienated many of his younger supporters, and those in Darfur not least. They felt themselves to be very much on their own. Meanwhile, the Derej government in Darfur faced a challenge it could not overcome, the worst drought in the province's recorded history. Year followed year without sufficient rain. The resources of the provincial government went to drill ever deeper wells, but not widely or quickly enough. By 1983, Derej was obliged to appeal to Khartoum to ask for foreign food aid for his stricken province. When his starvation letter was ignored, he went to the capital in person to plead his people's case. The dictator flew into a rage, and Ahmed Derej went into an exile from which he has never been able to return. Well, the famine that kills reached its peak in 1984 and 1985. The communities of Darfur fell back upon their most basic survival strategies. One was mobility. If my homeland has become uninhabitable, I must go somewhere else. But these unusual movements were often perceived as trespassing by the groups whose territories were entered. People fought, lives were lost. To use Gaddafi's terminology, many of the migrants were northern Arabs. Many of the unwilling hosts were Africans. A second survival strategy was to fall back upon wild hunger foods. Since some of these were not halal or Islamically proper, people who ate them could be condemned as less than Islamic by serious Islamists. As traditional food became increasingly controversial during these famine years, beer in particular came under attack, and here again it was the Zurga who were often perceived as the worst offenders. Now, the mishandling of the famine brought down Namari in 1985. A general named Sawada Dahab ran a brief caretaker regime, followed by elections and the return to power of Sadiq al-Mahdi. The new government was friendly toward Libya, and Gaddafi began a new round of interventions in Chad, using Darfur as a base, and some Darfur groups as recruits for his cause. Under these circumstances, the most dramatic consequence for Darfur as a whole was the flooding of the province with cheap AK-47 rifles during the height of the famine. In earlier times, acts of violence, though not necessarily uncommon, were restricted in their scope. Perpetrators could ordinarily be identified and held accountable. Custom established principles by which compensation could be paid and disputes between communities resolved. But the Kalashnikov changed all that. Now whole truckloads of people, whole villages could be exterminated, leaving no witnesses to tell the tale. The famine afforded opportunity for unusually numerous disputes. The AK-47 introduced a dramatic magnifier effect. When Gaddafi's Chadian adventure crashed and burned in 1987, undisciplined gangs of his supporters fell back on Darfur, made common cause with the local Arab racists, and began a career of pillage and rapine, largely at the expense of the Zurga, and particularly the four speakers, the documents known as Quraysh 1 and 2 that articulated the beliefs of these Libyan partisans were promulgated in that setting. The four sought their own Chadian allies, imported arms from N'Djamena, and organized militias in self-defense. By the end of 1987, a full-blown race war on Libyan principles was now underway in Darfur. The question was, how would the new government in Khartoum decide to handle the situation? Now, Sadiq's most urgent problem as he took power was the renewed insurgency in South Sudan. The bulk of the regular Sudanese armed forces were soon fully committed to the struggle in the south, a struggle in which they found themselves overextended and doubtful of victory. In response, Sadiq decided to arm communities within the south or along the southern borders, comprised of people who were hostile to the leaders of the SPLA-NM, many of whom were Bor Dinka. In Darfur, he also undertook to arm those communities perceived as loyal to his Ansar organization rather than to Hasna Tarabi's National Islamic Front. These new militia organizations were known as Murahaleen. The problem with the Murahaleen was that they were not under any normal form of government control. As these forces proliferated, so did the atrocities that accompanied them wherever they went. Now, while this problem existed everywhere, in Darfur it was far worse, for the groups armed, some of whom were motivated primarily by Chadian concerns, followed no predictable political agenda at all, save survival through robbery and murder. By the time the next dictator, Omar al-Bashir, seized power in 1989, the uncontrolled gangs of armed thugs who lived by preying upon the Africans of Darfur had acquired the fearsome nickname of Janjaweed, said to mean devils on horseback or something similar. The early years of Omar al-Bashir's dictatorship witnessed the Sudan's transformation in accordance with Islamist principles. This entailed diplomatic realignments abroad and a cultural revolution at home, financed by the godsend of discoveries of new Sudanese oil. Some people in Darfur, and I believe particularly the Masalit, perceived in the new Islamist state a possible solution to ethnic rivalries and the unfair privileges enjoyed by elites entrenched through the older political parties. Local leaders, supported by the central government, undertook a new round of attempts to broker deals that would have restored peace upon the payment of compensation for past atrocities. This was the traditional method by which solutions to Darfur's political problems had always been resolved, and perhaps it might have worked even in the high body count era of the Kalashnikov. So the early years of the 1990s did not see a restoration of peace, but for the moment, the crisis in Darfur had at least ceased to accelerate. The next stage along the road to disaster asks one to notice the idealism of the young people who rallied to the cause of the new Sudanese Islamist State. They truly believed that a government based on Islamic principles would bring justice. For example, soldiers and policemen recruited into the Sudanese armed forces from the communities of Darfur now would be promoted on the basis of their abilities and seniority. Western intellectuals would be taken seriously. Western professionals would enjoy opportunities for advancement. Western farmers would no longer be subject to predation on the part of self-proclaimed Arabs with racist Libyan attitudes. Islam, not Arabism, had prevailed. If that's the way things looked to the idealists, the reality, it turned out, was going to be something very different. The religious reformers in Khartoum, whatever else you can say about them, remained loyal members of the tiny hereditary elite that had dominated Sudanese politics ever since independence. As the years of the Bashir dictatorship lengthened, disillusionment with the Islamist experiment increased. New oil wealth flowed into the coffers of the old elite families. Opportunities for devout Muslims of non-elite origin were not forthcoming. Death by torture in ghost houses awaited anyone who objected. Hassan al-Turabi himself quarreled with the younger generation of his own proteges and was squeezed out of power. The insurgency in the south grew in strength, and the rebels, rather than attempting to secede as in decades past, now struck north into the Nuba Mountains and the hills of Upper Blue Nile Province. They threatened an eventual march of liberation on Khartoum itself. The shaky situation in Darfur, too, appeared threatening to Khartoum as Zurga self-defense groups began to make tentative contacts with the SPLA and other anti-government opposition groups. The Bashir regime first attempted to control Darfur during the last half of the 1990s through a policy of divide and rule. The province was placed under three potentially antagonistic administrations, one of these led for a time by my old haranguer, the soon-to-be disillusioned Ibrahim Yahya. Then the dictator made the fateful decision to attempt to subdue his real or potential opponents in Darfur through a new policy of alliance with the Janjaweed. And at a stroke, the racist Arabist agenda replaced the universalist Islamic one, and the Khartoum regime embraced a program of deliberate attempted genocide against the Africans of Darfur. The Masalit were the first to experience this new form of government-sponsored repression during the years from 1995 to 1999. In my view, the Sudan's Islamist experiment basically ended in May 2000 when idealists whose patience had finally snapped published a black book that detailed exactly how all significant offices were concentrated in the hands of a minuscule elite drawn from the Denagla, the Shaigia, and Jahliyin communities of the northern Nile Valley. The facts were not new, but the publication of this document was a challenge that was public and unprecedented. During the first 2 years of the new millennium, organized opposition groups began to appear in Darfur. One group called the Sudan Liberation Army is a large but disorganized alliance of convenience between members of the FUR, Nizrawa Tuer, and other groups. Many of its fighters are highly experienced in combat, but the organization lacks discipline and coherence. A second group, called the Justice and Equality Movement, consists of disillusioned Islamic idealists, notably ethnic Masalit. The movement is probably not as strong militarily as the SLA, but it is well organized and politically savvy. In the year 2003, both the SLA and the JEM announced their existence and formally opened hostilities against the local outposts of the Khartoum government. In response, the Khartoum authorities gave renewed levels of support to the Janjaweed, which they were able to do in part because the war in South was at least temporarily coming to an end. Experts from military intelligence with long experience in handling pro-government militias were now transferred from South Sudan to Darfur. Janjaweed officers began wearing Sudanese army uniforms and moving about in government vehicles and helicopters. At the same time, their somewhat distinct identity made it possible for the authorities in Khartoum to deny responsibility for their atrocities, which soon reached epic proportions. Hundreds of thousands of people fled as refugees to Chad. Perhaps 2 million others cluster in gigantic camps within Darfur itself, where they are slowly starving to death while being also terrorized by the Janjaweed. To wind down my discussion, I ask myself sometimes whether the old kings of Darfur would have recognized what is going on there today. And I believe that the answer is perhaps in part yes. They too forcibly rewrote ethnicity and reshaped the distribution of political power among their subjects in order to maintain and enhance their own power, and they did so precisely by means of disaffected and therefore co-optable pastoralists. However, the Khartoum government operates on a scale of violence totally inconceivable to the old kings, who might well have understood the present government's policies, but would not have tolerated anything approaching such a degree of suffering among their humble subjects. The difference lies not in morals, but in political economy. The old kings knew that their government ate taxes, which could derive only from that which exists. They needed productive and docile subjects, and they framed their policies accordingly. The current Khartoum regime, in contrast, exemplifies what my colleagues Ahmed and Abdi Samatar have called the suspended state, which relies entirely on foreign support. The Khartoum regime survives on oil revenues, largely from sales to China. Thus, the Khartoum regime needs the Chinese. But the presence of ordinary Sudanese, of any description, within the Sudan is entirely optional. Indeed, in many cases, the regime perceives them as a nuisance or worse. In my view, it is this attitude on the part of the Sudanese government toward the Sudanese people that lends some justification to the categorization of events in Darfur as having genocidal qualities. By 2004, the world had begun to notice the human catastrophe in Darfur. People such as yourselves have undertaken the effort to study and to organize, for which I thank you very much. Do not underestimate the importance and the power of your community of concern. Both the United Nations and the African Union have established a modest presence in Darfur. A series of talks between Khartoum and the rebels have begun. Both the SLA and the JEM have shown an unfortunate tendency to allow themselves to be divided by Khartoum agents who are second to none in the skills of political manipulation. The reign of terror continues. The future is uncertain. Thank you.